is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll explore the possible dangers with the use of e-cigarettes. Plus, we'll learn about local efforts to reduce the number of babies born to drug-dependent moms. But first, what you need to know about sarcoidosis and how it can affect your health. It's estimated that up to 4 in 10,000 people in the U.S. have sarcoidosis, an inflammatory disease that affects multiple organs in the body, but mostly the lungs and lymph glands. It can vary in its intensity from mild to severe, and in some cases can even lead to death. Well, here to tell us more about this disease and what can be done to treat it is Dr. Michael Iannuzzi. He's professor and chair of medicine at Upstate Medical University, specializing in pulmonary medicine. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So help us understand. Let's begin by helping us understand what exactly is sarcoidosis.
So as you said so well, it is an inflammatory disease, and the inflammation can occur in just about any organ in the body, as you mentioned, and it involves the lungs in over 90% of patients who have the disease. We don't know what starts the inflammation, what initiates the problem, and the inflammation is a particular kind of inflammation which we call granulomas. Now,
what does that exactly mean?
So to get you a picture in your mind, if you just imagine a water bowl on the floor and a dozen puppies all around that water bowl trying to get to it. Granulomas are the white cells in the body, specifically the lymphocytes and what we call macrophages, around a potential pathogen trying to eat it. And just as these puppies are trying to squeeze their way in and circling around the water bowl, the macrophages and lymphocytes are circling around some yet-to-be-identified pathogen, and these cascading circular cell buildup that form these granulomas.
Are they little masses then?
They're little masses of cells. And these little masses of cells then wreak their havoc by being there and interfering with the normal architecture of the organ. And then in interfering with its architecture can, in some cases, interfere with its function.
So in other words, this is something with the immune system gone awry.
Yes, it is an immune disorder. It is what we call a hyper sensitivity type of reaction where the immune system is turned on to a greater extent than it should be.
And as a result, these granulomas form. They get in the way of the functioning, both physically and potentially functionally, of a particular organ.
Yes.
And in the case of the lungs, what do they do?
So in the lungs, they build up, these granulomas build up in the lymph nodes, which result in no significant problem nearly all the time that they do occur. But it can get into the lung substance and in the airways of the lung, and that leads to loss in lung function.
Okay. What are the symptoms when we were talking about? Obviously, it depends on where you find them, but what kinds of symptoms can you expect to have?
Fatigue, sweating, weight loss, chest discomfort, shortness of breath, cough, joint aches, skin rashes. Those are the predominant symptoms.
It sounds like it's almost anything. It's pretty wide-ranging.
Yes, and I should point out that a large percentage of patients may have no symptoms, and the disease is detected when a chest x-ray is obtained for some other reason, screening physical exam or for some other complaints, and the enlarged lymph nodes or abnormalities in the lung itself are detected.
So there's a really a great variability even in terms of how the symptoms show themselves over time.
Yes, and that's what makes it confusing to many physicians and healthcare providers who face patients with these nonspecific symptoms and often don't think about sarcoidosis when the patient presents with these unusual symptoms that are difficult to pinpoint any one disease.
And sometimes they can begin suddenly or severely and then go away, and then they can come back. So that also must be very befuddling to the healthcare provider.
Yes, it can be an acute form, which can also involve vision, blurry vision, photophobia, the light hurting the eyes, as well as a skin rash and joint aches. Or it can be very insidious, not feeling well for months.
Yeah, that would be very difficult, I would think, to diagnose. And maybe people would be prone to thinking, well, it's all in my head, or I just have a kind of a little cold and it'll go away kind of thing.
Yes.
So do we know what causes it?
We don't know what caused it. We suspect that it's something in the air, something we breathe in. And the reason we suspect it's something in the air is because more than 90% of patients have lung involvement, so we breathe in the air.
So that would be the first site in many cases.
In many cases, but also the other common sites are the eyes and the skin, which are both always
exposed to the air.
So because of that pattern of organ involvement, we suspect it's an airborne
pathogen. But we really have no clue at this point as to what
it is. No, it happens all over the world. It happens in all climates. And for that reason, it's escaped us what the cause is.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Michael Iannuzzi, and we're talking about sarcoidosis. Well, who's most at risk for this disease?
Young women, they're 20 to 40s, are the highest, and African-American women have the highest risk for sarcoidosis, but it clearly can involve anyone at any age.
Do we think that because you mentioned the African-Americans have a higher rate, that there's some genetic predisposition to developing it?
Yes, we do, and we know that African-Americans more commonly have relatives, siblings and cousins, parents and children with sarcoidosis. So that led us to think more about this being a genetic predisposition to whatever is out there that we're all exposed to. In a lot of ways, it's a lot like, say, hay fever. We're all exposed to pollen, but not all of us react to it.
How is the disease diagnosed currently? I mean, how do you know? Because what I think I'm hearing from everything you're saying, it's almost like a mystery disease. It's almost, it can be mistaken for any number of other diseases, and it can come and go, and you don't even know you've had it.
There's three components to making the diagnosis: the clinical presentation, the signs and symptoms that the patient presents with, radiographic features, the imaging that shows a collection of these granulomas resulting in alteration of the way an organ looks on radiology.
And then you might have something in the lung, in a chest x-ray that shows some kind of pulmonary infiltrates or something in the lungs, or in the lymph nodes, some change.
Yes. That's the characteristic feature, is the chest x-ray abnormality. And then the third is by histologic confirmation or biopsying an affected organ and seeing these granulomas under the microscope.
So that's definitive.
I mean, that is what's required to make the diagnosis.
What do you do to treat it?
So,
and how often is it necessary to treat?
About a third of patients who have sarcoidosis, the disease comes and goes on its own, and within 1 or 2 years, often doesn't require more than an aspirin-like medication for joint aches or discomfort. A third of patients, the disease can come and last for 5-7 years and then require some anti-inflammatory medication, such as steroids, prednisone, And then there's alternative drugs that we use to help minimize the use of steroids. And there are several different types of drugs, including intravenous medication, that we can try to modulate the immune system. In a third of patients, the disease can progress, and our therapy may not be as effective in those patients.
How does your health play a role? In other words, are there other things that are, just in terms of good health practices, can help you fight this kind of disease or do better if you have it?
There are several things. One is to be in the best physical shape one could be in with exercise and diet. Having good exercise and keeping the respiratory system in as good a shape, the cardiovascular system and the respiratory system in as good a shape as possible, helps mitigate the symptoms of shortness of breath on exertion or shortness of breath, to keep one's weight at the ideal body weight, and to have a good sleep pattern. And
so generally, all the things that you would want to do to maintain good health. And how about smoking? Smoking, it seems to me, would be...
Smoking is absolutely forbidden.
Yeah, that would make real problems in the lungs.
It definitely adds fuel to the fire.
So what generally do you see in your practice in terms of the natural history of this kind of disease and the types of people that you treat?
Well, we see the whole spectrum of the disease, from patients in whom the disease was just detected on a chest X-ray and are asymptomatic and don't require much other than occasional monitoring, to people with severe involvement resulting in respiratory failure or cardiac failure, or even involving the neurologic system. So we see at Upstate the full gamut of patients. Perhaps because we're more of a referral center, we see the patients who are more severe.
But it can have lasting complications if it's untreated or if it's undiagnosed. Is that correct? So if you think you, I guess, what's the takeaway here?
The takeaway is for patients and their physicians to consider the disease when they present with these symptoms and signs, and to consider referring for further evaluation to clarify the diagnosis.
Yeah, it sounds to me like there are so many organ systems that could be affected, and you could have long-lasting problems with the lungs. I read somewhere that you could even have blindness with the eyes if it's untreated, heart problems, kidney problems, as you said, central nervous system problems. And because it masks itself, or it's somewhat unclear as to what it is, unless it's diagnosed, you really could, if left untreated, you could really end up in trouble.
Yes, and many patients tell us that they have been bouncing around for months before the correct diagnosis was arrived at.
Well, thanks so much for coming in with all this very interesting and important information. My guest has been Dr. Michael Iannuzzi. He's professor and chair of medicine at Upstate Medical University, specializing in pulmonary medicine. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, the possible dangers of using e-cigarettes. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Tobacco use is the largest preventable cause of death and disease in the United States. It's known to cause many types of cancer, as well as heart disease, stroke, lung disease, and other health problems. And smoking is the most popular form of tobacco use. But what about these new electronic cigarettes? Are they safe? And do they avoid all the dangers associated with the real McCoy? We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Leslie Coman, professor of surgery and the medical director of the Cancer Center at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Coman. Thanks for coming.
Good to be back, Linda.
So the marketers of e-cigarettes say they're safe. They're a safe alternative to traditional cigarettes. Is that true?
We have no evidence that that is true. In fact, we know that there are cancer-causing chemicals in e-cigarettes. We also know that they are not regulated in any way. They are manufactured in various locations around the world with no manufacturing controls, no safety controls whatsoever. The FDA has designated the main component in the product, propylene glycol or vegetable glycol, as generally recognized as safe. That's for eating. Inhaling it is very different.
That's a very key point.
Because the lungs absorb things in a very different way than the intestinal tract.
Well, that's a very key point. Help us understand. Let's start out, because I don't know how many of our listeners really have seen these e-cigarettes or have had any experience with them. What exactly are they? I mean, what do they look like and what do they do?
Many of them are designed to look just like a regular cigarette with a glowing tip. There are other varieties as well. They come in refillable and reusable or in disposable varieties. The basic element is a liquid substance is heated and the vapor is inhaled. This vapor contains a vehicle of propylene glycol or vegetable glycol, a flavoring, and nicotine, as well as who knows what else. 50% of the samples tested by the FDA contain some form of cancer-causing chemical.
Wow, so it's kind of illusory to think that, in fact, you're avoiding all of those other tars and potentially cancer-causing things that occur in real cigarette smoking.
Exactly. And the process of, it's not called smoking, it's called vaping. And when they exhale, it looks like you're breathing out smoke, but it's really water vapor with all these chemicals in it.
And there are all kinds of new flavorings they're
adding. The flavors are amazing. I was just looking at a website where you can customize your own nicotine level, your own propylene versus vegetable glycol mix, and over 100 different flavors. Chocolate mint, blackberry cola, butterscotch, popcorn, every possible flavor, many of which are aimed at kids. Bubble gum,
wow.
Cherry crunch.
That's a little frightening to me, especially with all of the efforts we've made to try to eliminate smoking in the younger populations. Basically, what you're saying is this is a seduction to smoking.
This is marketed to kids. You can double the flavor. You can order your flavor to be double in the liquid. Kids are not prevented from buying these. They're not taxed the way regular cigarettes are.
I want to get right to that stuff in a minute, but what I want to understand is the people who are favoring e-cigarettes. I mean, obviously there's a financial incentive, but what are some of their arguments as to why this would be preferable to cigarette smoking?
Well, first you have to remember that all of the e-cigarettes are made by major tobacco companies. So as smoking traditional cigarettes fall, to keep their business up, they want to sell this product. So anything you hear in favor has to be colored by that.
Who's the messenger?
And the nicotine in e-cigarettes is made from tobacco. It is a tobacco product.
So let's get one thing straight. If you continue to take nicotine in, is nicotine considered one of the cancer-causing agents as well? I mean, if they haven't eliminated nicotine, is there a basic fallacy there?
Nicotine is not the cancer-causing agent in cigarettes. It's all the other things, the burning tobacco. So nicotine itself is the addictive agent, which is the reason that people smoke cigarettes. People don't smoke cigarettes for tobacco flavor or the pleasant sensation they get. They smoke it for the hit of nicotine and because they're heavily addicted to nicotine.
Now, I've read some of the arguments, things like
you basically don't have the 7,000 plus chemicals that you get in a regular burned cigarette. Things like there's an absence of secondhand cigarette smoke, which could be a benefit, I mean, to the people and the whole environment. And that that it could be an aid to smoking cessation. What do you say to any of those?
Well, if that were really true, it might be very helpful. However, there is no evidence that this is more effective in helping people quit regular cigarettes than the traditional methods we know of counseling, nicotine replacement therapy, and other prescription drugs. We also know that most smokers who switch to e-cigarettes continue to smoke regular cigarettes. In fact, 80% of high schoolers who use e-cigarettes also smoke regular cigarettes.
That's alarming.
It's alarming. And the most alarming thing is, as this is supposedly becoming accepted in society because it's theoretically less dangerous, cigarette smoking is becoming re-normalized. As these are not banned in many places, such as restaurants and bars, you're beginning to see what looks like smoking behavior going on. This is extremely dangerous from a public health point of view.
So it's, I mean, basically what you're doing is it's almost providing a gateway, or it's, as you said, culturally, we're beginning to re-embrace the sophistication, perhaps, the, you know, all of that stuff that goes with having a cigarette.
Right. And the websites for the companies are beginning to feature clips from movies where the actor is smoking an e-cigarette. Four major cities now, Los Angeles just joined New York, Boston, and Chicago in banning e-cigarettes.
Banning the sale anywhere in those cities?
I don't know the exact
But that's a pretty
thing
major
about sales,
step.
But using them in public, just like regular cigarettes in public places.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Leslie Coleman. She's the medical director of Upstate's Cancer Center. And we're talking about e-cigarettes, or electronic cigarettes, actually. Obviously, there are a lot of reasons you've already enumerated to be cautious. They say that they're in the process of doing research studies, but I came across something that actual FDA studies have found these cancer-causing substances, and I guess in half of the e-cigarette samples that they tested, and they found that there were very serious other things that could be of concern public health-wise. And yet, what is being done, if anything, to regulate?
Well, all that's being done so far is that these four major cities and many other smaller communities have begun to regulate them. The FDA has not yet begun to regulate it, although they can, because it is a tobacco product and they're authorized to do so. So there's a big push to get the FDA to begin to regulate them. One of the other dangers that you don't hear much about is the flavor cartridges. If they were to spill or kids were to get their hands on them, there can be a toxic, even lethal level of nicotine in this very candy-flavored syrup.
And those are the refillable ones, so you might have these cartridges anywhere in someone's home.
Right, and the propylene glycol makes it very sweet, and these flavors are enticing to children, and children with a lower body mass are much more subjected to the same degree of toxin that might not be fatal to an adult.
And the point that you made to me that high school students are using both strikes me as a very worrisome concept, because it's almost like this can serve as a gateway, perhaps, to more involved tobacco use of a whole variety of types.
Absolutely. They will become addicted to nicotine if they use e-cigarettes with nicotine. And the use of e-cigarettes among high school kids doubled between 2011 and 2012. And the use of other tobacco products is also increasing greatly in kids. Hookah pipes, beedies, flavored cigars. Cigarettes aren't allowed to be flavored with anything except menthol, but it doesn't extend to little cigars. And little cigars are not much different from cigarettes, but they can be flavored with any of these candy flavors as well. And clove cigarettes, they don't just contain cloves. They contain 60 to 70% tobacco as well. So kids Wow. are being lured into many forms of tobacco abuse and nicotine use where they don't really realize the risk.
How about the regulation aspects of it? I mean, you were saying they have, it's within their bailiwick, so to speak, to FDA to regulate, but it doesn't sound like they're doing much at this point.
Well, this is very new on the scene, and we know that government agencies work kind of slowly.
Glacial speed.
So I'm not... because there's not much data, the FDA is trying to be cautious because we don't have evidence one way or the other about many of these health effects. We really fear for the public health danger and the social consequences of making it look normal to be walking around with something that looks like a cigarette. So we have to continue to gather real information so that the FDA can make a ruling based on facts. If they were to rule now, they would be overwhelmed by objections for lack of data.
And in effect, you're talking, you know, we are, you know, free society in the sense that we want to, you know, encourage capitalism, and you can't be regulating everything over the top. But in this case, as you said, there are indications already at this early stage that there are public health concerns.
There are public health concerns that are considerable. We do not know that the exhaled vapor that other people inhale is actually safe.
So this whole argument of no secondhand smoke effects could be fallacious as well.
It's not smoke. We don't know. It's probably not very cancer-causing, but some people are allergic to propylene glycol. Would that affect somebody who breathes it in next to an e-cigarette smoker? We just don't know.
So the jury is out, but clearly there are concerns.
Yes.
Very big concerns.
Yes.
And you, especially in your whole experience, your whole medical professional experience, you've seen all of the deleterious effects that tobacco can
right.
can cause.
Right. And the jury is not out on its danger to kids becoming addicted to nicotine, to its marketing to kids, and to this being a ploy for large tobacco companies to stay in business with new markets.
Well, you certainly made the point very clearly to me, and I appreciate your coming in. And, you know, making it for all of our listeners. My guest has been Dr. Leslie Coleman, professor of surgery and the medical director of the Cancer Center at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, this is registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator Julie Mellon with Healthy Eats. In this week's segment, I'd like to talk about nutrition during pregnancy. Eating healthy during pregnancy is one of the best things you can do for yourself and your baby. When you're pregnant, you need extra calories and nutrients. That does not mean you want to eat twice as much as normal. In fact, most women only need about 300 extra calories each day after the first trimester. Eating well, along with regular physical activity, is going to fuel your baby's growth and keep you healthy during pregnancy. I encourage you to use the MyPlate eating guidelines, which can be found on the website myplate.gov. MyPlate is a great tool to guide you in making healthy choices to meet your changing needs. We all know that with pregnancy comes weight gain, a weight gain of 1 to 4 pounds during the first trimester and 2 to 4 pounds a month during the second and third trimester is a good guide. The recommendations for total weight gain and weight gain pattern during pregnancy are based on your pre-pregnant body mass index, or BMI. Basically, the higher your BMI, the less weight you want to gain. Here are some healthy habits to keep in mind during pregnancy. Try to eat 3 balanced meals and 2 to 3 snacks each day. Take a prenatal vitamin. Most doctors recommend a prenatal vitamin and mineral supplement in addition to eating a healthy diet. A prenatal vitamin has extra folic acid, which is a B vitamin that helps prevent birth defects of your baby's brain and spine. And it also contains extra iron, which is needed for the increasing amount of blood in your body during pregnancy. Iron works to keep your blood healthy and able to carry oxygen to your cells. In addition to a prenatal vitamin, consider a DHA omega-3 essential fatty acid supplement. DHA is important for the development of the baby's brain and eyes during the third trimester and up to 18 months of life. Stay hydrated. Water is best. Choose whole fruit instead of fruit juice and aim for 2 cups of fruit each day. Vary your vegetables and eat lots of them, at least 3 cups a day. Choose all different colors and eat more dark green and orange vegetables and cook dried beans. Make half of your grains whole, such as whole wheat bread, whole grain cereals, brown rice, whole wheat pasta, oatmeal, and even popcorn. Protein is also very important in pregnancy. Protein promotes growth. Choose lean meats and poultry and vary your protein with the many different legumes, nuts, and fish. Include a source of protein at each meal. Get calcium-rich foods to protect your bones. At least 3 servings of dairy each day, such as low-fat milk and fat-free milk, yogurt, and cheese to meet your pregnancy needs. To prevent excess weight gain, choose healthy fats in small quantities. Soft spreads, canola and olive oil, peanut oil, avocado, nuts, seeds. Limit foods that are high in sugar, fat, salt, and calories, and low in nutrients. Some examples of these would be soft drinks, desserts, chips, fried foods, and fast foods. Get daily exercise if it's okay with your healthcare provider. Sleep at least 8 hours. Limit caffeine to no more than 1 to 2 servings a day. Avoid taking any herbal supplements unless you run them by your doctor. Avoid cigarettes, alcohol, and other drugs. And keep your doctor's appointments. Pregnancy is such an exciting time. This is your golden opportunity to have a positive influence on how your child is formed. Make every bite count. Get daily exercise and adequate rest and really experience and enjoy your pregnancy and your changing body. More on food safety for the mom-to-be in my next edition of Healthy Eats. This has been registered dietitian Julie Mellon serving you Healthy Eats.
Coming up next, local efforts to reduce the number of babies born to drug-dependent moms. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for April 7th. Snacking can be your ally or enemy, depending on how you do it. Fresh fruit, raw veggies, nuts, raisins, and low-fat yogurt will keep you satisfied until your next meal, while prepackaged chips and other treats will load you with empty calories. They're like the popular kids who used to beat you up and take your cafeteria money. Or was that just us? Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. The rate of babies born to mothers who use prescription painkillers during pregnancy has risen sharply over the last decade in this country. And the number of babies born suffering from withdrawal symptoms due to their mother's use of these prescription painkillers more than tripled between 2000 and 2009, according to a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, making this situation a true public health emergency. Well, here with more on this are Dr. Cynthia Morrow. She's Onondaga County's Commissioner of Health, and Gail Bannock, the Director of Public Education and Communications for the Upstate New York Poison Center. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you, Linda.
So, Dr. Morrow, tell us, many more babies are being born dependent on drugs. Tell us about that.
Right. If we look at our numbers, and this is a much broader number than just prescription drug use. But if we look at a number of babies who are discharged from the hospital after they're born with what we call drug-related discharges, which could be a variety of things, you know, associated with marijuana use, for example, or illegal drug use, our rates are four times the state average. And that really caught our attention, and it became something that we've been amazed at how much the community is rallying around.
So you're saying locally our rates are even higher than they are nationally?
Absolutely. We're comparing them primarily to New York State, and Onondaga is four times the state average.
Wow.
There are some problems with those numbers, but regardless, we are extraordinarily high.
So
we're an outlier.
That got your attention.
Absolutely. Wow. And it's been amazing to see the response from community partners. There's just been a real rallying around this, and that's what we want to do. We want to get together as a community to address how we can figure out ways to decrease this problem.
What drugs are we actually talking about?
Looking at a local study that we did, thanks to Laboratory Alliance of Central New York, we found that the two most common drugs that were identified in moms who were delivering or in babies who were just born were cannabinoids, so marijuana-associated drugs, and opioids. So those could be either prescription painkillers or illegal drugs.
What strikes me is, though, when you talk about something, that could have been prescribed, does it really matter if the person is dependent during pregnancy and abusing the use of that drug, whether it's been prescribed or not?
Well, the greatest concern that we have is with opioids, because with opioids, there's a greater risk that when that child is born, that child is born dependent on drugs. And that child can actually have what we call neonatal abstinence syndrome, which is the worst case scenario where the baby actually becomes physically ill as it withdraws from exposure to drugs. But whether or not the exposure is because it's been prescribed or being abused, from the baby's perspective, it doesn't matter. From the healthcare delivery standpoint, we want to understand why women are using, why they're exposing their babies. And I think that it's very different if there's a woman who's under the care of a physician who's unintentionally exposing a baby to opioids versus a woman who has all sorts of disadvantages, who may be using drugs as a self-medication. It's a very different approach how we need to handle that woman.
What exactly happens to the baby, though? You talked about this abstinence syndrome.
Right.
What do you see? Are they more irritable? Are they more...
Absolutely. So a baby who has neonatal abstinence syndrome usually ends up in the neonatal intensive care unit, and that baby can have symptoms similar to what what an adult has when an adult is going through withdrawal. So the baby can be very irritable. The baby can even have seizures, vomiting, in worst case scenario, respiratory distress, and maybe a less severe example would be trouble feeding. But regardless, that baby is at increased risk for poor outcome, and that baby needs to be in the neonatal intensive care unit for monitoring.
I read somewhere that they actually could have a low birth weight secondary to as a result of this kind of use during pregnancy. And that we know even though it's not a direct link, it's often associated with later developmental problems as well.
Sure. We don't have a very good understanding of what the long-term effects of exposure to poisons in utero are specifically, but certainly we'd be very concerned about the long-term development of a baby who experiences neonatal abstinence syndrome.
So, Gail, we know that these mothers are taking these drugs. What in your estimate is the important thing we need to start to do to make a difference here?
Well, I think, first of all, to bring attention to the fact that this problem exists. First, you have to identify the problem, right? And secondly, to let the women who are addicted and who are pregnant or even thinking of becoming pregnant know that there is help out there for them.
Isn't that a key, though? It's not just if you're pregnant, but if you're considering pregnancy, because these drugs can have an impact on you immediately, because isn't it the very, very earliest stages of development time of pregnancy that are the most crucial?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that Gail and I and many of our community partners are really intent on is eliminating any exposure of babies to drugs. And that's our goal, is to eliminate it. And we have a lot of resources in our community as Gail said, we have to raise awareness, but we have to give women hope. And there is a lot of hope in our community. We have so many resources right now at our disposal.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's Medical University's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Cynthia Morrow. She's the Onondaga County Health Commissioner, and Gail Bannock, the Director of Public Education and Communications for Upstate New York Poison Center. And we're talking about babies born dependent on drugs. So what's going on in the community? Tell us more about your efforts, Gail.
Well, we're really excited, as Dr. Morrow pointed out, that many of the agencies and organizations and hospitals in the area have jumped on board with this because they realize the significance and how important it is in our community to address the issue. The Prevention Network, the three area hospitals, CNY, the Upstate New York Poison Center, and many other organizations, including, as I said, the three hospitals, are looking at this issue. And one of the efforts that we've already started with was identifying the target areas where there's a higher prevalence. And so we...
Target areas, you're talking demographically.
Correct.
Physical location.
Right.
Neighborhoods.
So the study that Dr. Morrow was referring to, the... three areas that were targeted of in the higher the number of instances in that particular zip code are the areas where we targeted for our billboard campaign. So we developed a billboard. We've got materials developed that we're distributing now through many agencies, through the efforts of many people on this committee. And we're also looking at screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment, which is extremely important. And we're providing training and have provided training to community members through clinics and social organizations and agencies to instruct caregivers on whatever level, the people who come in contact with the person who might have this issue, to ask them some questions that may help provide indications that there may be a drug problem.
You know, so often people are told, talk to your doctor if you have a problem. And it strikes me that in this situation, especially if potentially the drug use is illicit, no one's going to talk to the doctor. So how do you get through to the person? How do you get through to this soon-to-be mother or someone contemplating pregnancy?
Yeah, well, that's part of this training, you know, that we're looking to work with that person that has the face-to-face. So, again, whether it's a social worker, whether it's some other level of health care provider, to let them know that the questions need to be asked. And there are all kinds of studies out there that indicate that if the question isn't asked, you're not going to find out the answer. So it's very important that the questions be asked so that if there are any indications after responding to those questions that there may indeed be a drug issue, that it moves to the next level. So whether that might be referral to treatment or whether that might be more questions being asked or a discussion or information gathering session, whatever it may be, at least the question is asked and the identification is made.
So is it your effort to try to get these people who are the healthcare, I don't know how you put it, the people who interface with these moms, soon-to-be moms, to be comfortable enough to ask the right questions, maybe that is not necessarily part of their training initially, and to really kind of push or be aware and alerted to the fact that this could be a problem for these moms?
One of the things when we look back at what we've done is it's really a multi-pronged approach. So we're training the healthcare delivery system, the traditional healthcare delivery system. We're training people who work with the healthcare delivery system. We've actually put in a grant with the New York State Health Foundation to train people within the community to be what we call community connectors. Because you're absolutely right. A woman may not feel comfortable, one, admitting to herself that she is facing drug problems, but two, admitting it to someone else. And so we need to create a safe environment where women know that we are here, we, the community, is here to help them and help address any problems that led them to the point where they were using drugs. We also know that women who are pregnant, in general, are more motivated for behavioral change because most women, when they find that they're pregnant, will do whatever they can to protect that infant, that fetus. And so it's really important for us to seize this moment, educate as many people as we can in our community, including lay leaders, including people in churches, so that we recognize the problem and educate people. I think the one thing that, Gail is being very modest about is that she and some others worked with women who went through treatment and were pregnant and developed the campaign materials based on their input. So,
wow. So
the materials are really based on what the women felt was the most important thing to them in reaching them and engaging them.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. key, it seems to me, because you can develop all kinds of materials, and if you're talking above them, below them, around them, you're not going to reach them. So obviously, if you've developed the materials from the people who are most in need of them, you know, with their input, then it's going to be the most effective.
And if I may say, Linda, I think that the most moving piece for me was when one of those women who had attended two of the sessions and had seen, worked with us in the development of the pieces, and when she finally saw the pieces, looked at me and her mouth open, she pointed to the screen and said, "That's exactly what we said." And I looked
listened.
At her and I said, "Well, of course, we listened."
Wonderful.
And she looked at me and she said, with tears in her eyes, she said, "But nobody listens to us." And so it was, you know, a good feeling for us.
Quite telling.
And I think, too, the reality is in public health, oftentimes we feel that we've got a message to get out, but we don't take into consideration how and in what mode that the people who are the consumers need to receive that message.
The importance of partnership here.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's the key message, Linda, is we have a community problem. This affects all of us. When our children are impacted, our community is impacted. And it's just been a beautiful example for me to see how our community has come together with partners who just, people are coming out of the woodwork wanting to help address this problem.
So how long has this been going on right now, roughly?
Well, if we look back, the partnership between Upstate Poison Control and Prevention Network, the health department, mental health, social services, really got going with the bath salt threat.
Right.
And synthetic marijuana, and so it's been going on for a couple of years. But this intense effort, probably about a year, I would
mm-hmm.
guess.
And what are you seeing? Tell us about some of your successes. What are your greatest challenges?
Well, we're still in the early stages mm-hmm. of implementation, so we don't have our measurable outcomes yet. But we certainly have the metrics out there, and we'll be very happy once we have enough time into this to start seeing some outcomes.
Absolutely. And one thing I did want to mention too is our the Hope Line that we set up through Contact takes phone calls directly from moms who are looking for help. And so it is important to note that there is a phone number.
Tell us that number.
And as we always say, there is hope,
there
because
is hope.
That was a focus that the women in the group were very excited about. The number is 315-218-1965. And again, that's for someone who's looking for help, that is addicted and mom or to be pregnant.
Wonderful.
It's all confidential. It's really important for us to protect the women.
My guests have been Dr. Cynthia Morrow, Onondaga County Commissioner of Health, and Gail Bannock, the Director of Public Education and Communications for the Upstate New York Poison Center. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Sometimes illness brings with it an accompanying weakness or disability. It can be both painful and instructive, negotiating life with this new condition. Jane Seskin is a clinical social worker and an author of 10 books. She worked for 20 years with survivors of violent crimes in New York City at the Crime Victims Treatment Center. Her clients certainly knew about how one can sometimes feel voiceless. But Seskin's poem, When I Was Silent, shows us what she learned when suddenly she could not speak. I think her words are meaningful for all of us engaged in patient care. When I Was Silent, by Jane Seskin. People understood when I pointed to my throat and shook my head no, when I was silent for a week in the city. During this time, I carried a pad and pen, but still yearned to be seen with my voice, and noted with melancholy the absence of conversations I regularly have with my neighborhood. I missed saying to friends, "Hello, yes, please, I'm sorry, thanks, I'd like you to, let's talk again, love you." Girl Scout sensibilities were thrown off balance as I couldn't yell to stop a fight or offer street directions to a tourist. Vocally impotent, I settled into quietude with gestures. I still longed for my voice, which I did indeed like, but surprisingly, had many interactions where people smiled at me with kindness, seeing my moments of vulnerability. And I learned. The silence thundered, pay attention to family, friends, self, life. Talk less, listen more.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we take a look at cancer survivorship and learn all about the challenges of surviving breast cancer, as well as cancers of the head and neck, and how vascular surgery is helping patients with diabetes avoid complications. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast up on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And if you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Sirio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.